Horace Silver on piano with his own composition, Señor Blues, a jazz classic. This is his originally recorded tune in 1956, although it was not officially released until 1960-something, some years after. I forgot, 1969, I think, something like that. And it's from his album, Horace Silver, The Very Best. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And, well, it's raining like crazy here. Terrible thunderstorms. But that's one thing. It's the lightning and the thunder I can't take. All around me, alarms are going off. The cars are being affected by the lightning, and alarms are going off. So it's quite a cacophony here, but this is life. I want to welcome back today, 1 week after he has been here, the one, the only, the incomparable. Well, say your name.
Hello, Gerald Borger.
Yes. How are you doing? How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
That is the voice of Gerald Horn, who was with us last week talking about his recently published book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. It's a great book, and you ought to get a copy as soon as you possibly can and begin reading it, because there are many other books by him to follow. I know he has a book on jazz that's coming up. That would be of very great interest to me. And we have, after that, a book on boxing. How are you doing, Gerald?
Oh, all good. How about yourself?
I'm hanging in. This is a really crazy day with all this thunder and lightning, though, but we just push through. That's all we have to do. Now, we're going to be talking about, I was hoping that we would talk about the second item first, but we're going to switch because of the recent development, and that being the nomination of Kamala Harris to be the running mate of Joe Biden. So let's start there. I'll give a little thought to it. You have to come back to it, of course, and deal with it in greater detail. But what's your first impression?
Well, my first impression is thinking of Charlotta Bass, the black woman from Los Angeles who ran for vice president in 1952 on the Progressive Party ticket to the left of the Democrats and Republicans. And interestingly enough, part of the Progressive Party was Vincent Hallinan of San Francisco. And Kamala Harris, when she was first catapulted into prominence in San Francisco, she defeated his son. San Francisco politics are rather unusual in terms of the United States, although I look forward to it becoming the norm in the United States. What I mean is that the battles are mostly between liberals and those to the left of liberalism. And Kamala was part of the liberal faction. She defeated Hallinan, who was part of the left of liberal faction. And then, as San Francisco DA, as you probably know, she accumulates this reputation of being the so-called top cop in California. Although, if you look at USA Today this morning, there's an interesting editorial op-ed piece by Nikki Solis, who is a leading public defender in San Francisco. That is to say, she defends the people that Kamala's office was prosecuting. And she issues a lengthy and spirited defense, interestingly enough, of Kamala's record. The issue that's not being ventilated to a degree, in the U.S. press at least, is the other half of her ancestry, that is to say, South Asian, more specifically Tamil. I don't think that that was an irrelevant consideration in terms of her being picked in light of this new Cold War. In fact, in some ways, it's worse because Secretary of State Michael Pompeo, speaking at the Nixon Library a few weeks ago, basically called for regime change in China. And India is touted as being part of this encirclement plan of encircling China. And I dare say that if the Democrats win in November, Vice President Harris will be heading towards New Delhi by February. I think that this campaign will be racist and sexist. With regard to the former, I'm sure much will be made about the role of her erstwhile mentor, the former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown, who happens to be a Black American with roots in Texas, and the role that he played in catapulting her into prominence in the first place, which will have overtones of sexism, I'm sure. Which brings me to the overriding point, which is that even though some of our friends on the left don't want to confront this, the fact of the matter is that there's no guarantee that the oath in the Oval Office will lose on November 3rd, 2020. In fact, I've seen projections that he could lose the popular vote by 5 to 6 million votes and then win pursuant to the slavery-driven, constitutionally mandated Electoral College. So this is going to be a very troublesome next 90 days, roughly.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Willie Brown, because he did advise her not to accept the position should it be offered her by Joe Biden. He said in a very interesting language, he said to offer Biden a polite a polite no, and leave it at that, but to not take the position. It was his belief that she could lose a lot more than she would gain in the short run. If she took the position, she would be sacrificing very possibly a long-term greater goal, which is actually to be president. And he said, don't take the position, even if it's offered you, just politely decline, he said. What do you think about that?
Well, I interpreted that as another example of Willie Brown being a slick and sly operator. I think in the run-up...
A slick and sly operator.
Well, no, in the run-up to Kamala being selected, there was a lot of jockeying. And I think that Congresswoman Karen Bass of Los Angeles became part of the collateral damage of this jockeying. In other words, I think that her name was floated to take this position as vice presidential nominee, in part to reduce the leverage of Kamala as she was negotiating with the Biden circle. Because, of course, there are all these rumors coming out of the Biden circle, denigrating her, et cetera, which might reduce her leverage in terms of what kind of deals she, of what kind of vice president she could be, assuming that they win. And so as a result, Congresswoman Bass, who comes out of the left in California, worked with the Vincent Ramos Brigade, which is in solidarity with the Cuban Revolution, and had said very positive things about late communists in the United States of America. Once her name floated as a vice presidential nominee, she felt compelled to walk back those previous words and then damaged her credibility as a result, making her appear to be an inefficient opportunist. In other words, you were an opportunist and then didn't even get what you supposedly desired. And I'm not even sure if that was coincidental, this collateral damage to the leader of the Congressional Black Caucus. And I think when Willie wrote that piece, he was trying to give her leverage, the fact that, well, you know, I can't say no to this overture to be vice president. And, of course, about 2 or 3 days after Willie's piece was published in the San Francisco Chronicle, she, of course, said yes and will be appearing with Mr. Biden in Wilmington, Delaware this afternoon.
Do you believe that this would help Biden immeasurably?
It's hard to say. I mean, political analysts whose credibility I do not challenge argue that amongst a broad swath of the Euro-American middle class and working class, there is an instinctive revulsion to seeing someone so close to power who is not melanin deficient. And being of South Asian and Jamaican ancestry, therefore, there could be a revulsion. I mean, look, there was revulsion towards Obama, even though he governed as a centrist. And so I think that we should not replicate and repeat the short-sighted, myopic mistakes of some of the liberals who somehow can't get their heads around this idea of white supremacy and racism, and therefore have analyses that come up short. On the other hand, it's possible that amongst that same Euro-American working class and middle class, her erstwhile reputation as the so-called top cop might help her. Recall that before Mr. Obama's profile became clear, there were many in the Euro-American population who felt that he could be an ideal candidate to crack down on the Negroes. And they may think that Kamala also fits that bill, although I think that they may wind up being disappointed.
I think so, too, in that regard. So how do you think Trump is receiving this news?
Well, you know, they already have a nickname for her, although I think they'll come up with a new one. The nickname was Phony Kamala. I'm not sure if that'll fly. It's not enough alliteration, for example. I think that he's called her nasty, quote unquote, because of her justifiably denigrating Mr. Biden's record, consorting with segregationists and being opposed to busing. People have short memories, malignant amnesia in this country, and they don't recall that Mr. Biden, early in his career, and for a good deal of his career, carved out this reputation of being a kind of centrist, if not new Democrat, so-called, who could get along with Strom Thurmond, the late segregationist senator from South Carolina. In fact, that's one of the reasons Barack Obama selected him as vice president, because he thought it would reassure these Euro-Americans who get nervous every time a black person gets close to office, that Mr. Biden would be there to restrain his alleged impulses. But once again, since our liberal friends, you know, their knowledge of the history and reality of the United States is superficial at best, they do not necessarily echo the kind of analysis I'm putting forward, sadly enough.
Do you feel that you have a fix on Kamala Harris's politics?
Well, I mean, you can look at her record. I mean, that's the best indication. For example, I mentioned earlier her jetting off to New Delhi in February. Well, Prime Minister Modi was not happy when she issued a statement criticizing his crackdown on Kashmir, the majority Muslim province of India, that Pakistan claims as part of its own territory. And it's been a flashpoint between Islamabad and Delhi for decades now. So I think that she has a record. I mean, she's voted on many issues in the U.S. Senate. She has a record as Attorney General. And once again, I would recommend the piece in USA Today this morning with regard to her record as district attorney in San Francisco.
One thing I did pick up was the fact that her father is not as referenced as her mother is. Her father being a Jamaican immigrant. Her mother is also an immigrant. But there was a tendency to focus more on the contributions of the mother and not so much of her father. Do you pick that up?
Well, yeah. I mean, the parents divorced early on, and the mother, as so often happens, was left to raise the two daughters. By the way, her brother-in-law, Tony West, is a former Obama administration official whose married to Kamala's sister, Maya, one of her key advisors. And he is part of the 1% of Black America, being a leading official in Uber, which has fallen on hard times lately because of the pandemic. So we shall see how that pans out. In any case, Mr. Harris, Professor Harris, her father, has been critical of his offspring, critical of his daughter, after she gave certain interviews. And it'll be interesting to see if from his perch in Jamaica, he will continue to issue statements or whether he'll take a vow of silence. And in any case, the reading that I get from Jamaica, albeit this may be a bit premature, is that they are not displeased with the fact that one they consider to be one of their favorite daughters is a heartbeat away from the presidency. And we'll see how that evolves once or if she assumes the mantle of power and, as an officer of U.S. imperialism, may be forced to take actions that are inimical to the interests not only of Jamaica, but of the Pan-African world.
Well, that leads us into a good segue here, and that concerns giving us a quick tour, if you will, of burgeoning hotspots all over the world and why we should pay attention to these things. Let's start with China, Russia, India, and Japan.
Well, why we should pay attention is the easiest part to answer. Just recently, former Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, who now lives in the United States but has very good contacts in China since he speaks Putonghua, the Chinese language, Mandarin, as it's called over here, and has good contacts in Washington, he predicted that the United States and China might be at war before Election Day, which I thought was, you know, rather extravagant, but he has better contacts than I do. And it does bespeak this rising level of tension, which is quite extraordinary, between Washington and Beijing. As I said, Mr. Pompeo, the U.S. Secretary of State, basically called for a regime change in the second largest economy, speaking of China. And what's interesting as well is that when the United States, I think, they botched U.S. foreign policy, even from the point of view of imperialism. What I gave a talk the other day where I pointed out how post-1991, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, you even had many leading so-called Black intellectuals who were dancing on the graves of socialism and claiming that, quote, communism is dead. But the Communist Party of China was still in power. Communist Party in Cuba was still in power. As I said, it was equivalent to breaking into your touchdown dance, not in the end zone, but on the 30-yard line. And so now the chickens have come home to roost. China has emerged from the pandemic much faster than the United States has. The United States economy, of course, is losing altitude. And then at the same time, the United States is not able to, at least as of yet, broker the kinds of alliances that would be needed to engage in a new Cold War, let alone regime change. For example, the United States has not good relations with Canada, slapping tariffs on Canadian exports of aluminum, despite the fact that Canada has carried water to the United States by detaining for almost 2 years or more the daughter of the founder of Huawei, the Chinese telecommunications giant. She's detained in Vancouver, British Columbia, for supposedly violating U.S. sanctions against Iran. The United States would obviously need the European Union if it's going to confront China. But Mr. Trump has very strained relations with Germany, the locomotive of the European Union. In fact, in his tell-all memoir, the sacked National Security Advisor John Bolton says that Mr. Trump sees the European Union as number two to China in terms of his rogues gallery and list of enemies. And then these analysts in the United States, with a malignant form of amnesia, don't seem to recall that a turning point in terms of the breakdown of the former Soviet Union was precisely the ability to enlist China in an anti-Soviet alliance in the early 1970s per Nixon's path-breaking trip to China. And so you would think that they'd do a reverse Nixon, which, in fact, Henry Kissinger, to be fair, has made a small fortune from U.S. corporations going to China. He suggested that the United States basically reorient its relations with Moscow, try to have better relations with Moscow to turn Moscow against China. Now, I don't think that that's going to work. As a matter of fact, President Putin and President Xi have met so often, so frequently. As a matter of fact, President Xi calls President Putin one of his best friends in the whole world. Their relations are so close that people are even beginning to talk and whisper about what is the exact nature of this
friendship. People are beginning to talk.
Right. And so, but at the same time, both the Democrats, well, certainly the Democrats, they want to have strained relations with Moscow and Beijing. And the Republicans Party, and I chose that two-word phrase carefully, basically echoes the Democratic Party with regard to their policies, particularly if you listen to Michael Pompeo. So I don't know. I mean, and then, of course, Japan had been encouraging the United States to confront China more aggressively. But now that the United States is doing so, Japan won't necessarily even hold the United States' coat. If the United States takes it off and wants to rumble with China, it's speaking in very soft tones nowadays. So I don't think you can rely on Tokyo either with regard to this confrontation. And then Australia, which is another part member of this cabal, it's a small nation that's trying to punch above its weight, only 25 million people. An economy heavily dependent upon economic ties to China. And it's really, I think, getting it over its head by echoing Uncle Sam's more pugnacious rhetoric, which could lead to hard times ahead for this COVID-infected country, which, of course, has not done as good a job as neighboring New Zealand in helping to beat back the coronavirus. So right now, I would say that the road ahead is rather complicated for Washington. And once again, since it's not clear that Mr. Trump will be defeated on November 3rd, 2020, it's not clear what's going to happen, what's going to befall the United States of America as it tries to ramp up tensions with China, which is taking the Rodney King line as of today, which is, can't we all get along? Because things are going China's way. I mean, why should they want some sort of military conflict with the number one military power on planet Earth when the dollar is plummeting, the price of gold is rising, China is emerging from the pandemic with all pistons blazing? So Washington, as ever, has painted itself into a tight corner.
Let's move to another region, Libya, Turkey, Egypt, and Ethiopia.
Well, I mentioned a moment ago about how Jamaicans might be displeased if Vice President Harris had to execute policies congruent with U.S. imperialism. And that brings me to a recent article suggesting that the 44th U.S. president was having trouble completing his memoirs. And I speculated that it was because he has trouble explaining the debacle that he and his NATO allies created in Libya in 2011 when Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown, leading to chaos in that North African nation. And by the way, it's led to a special persecution of not only darker-skinned Libyans, but also those migrating from the south of Libya to try to find a gateway to the European Union, and therefore drowning in the Mediterranean if they're not tortured and raped and murdered in Libya itself by these religious zealots who took over after Gaddafi was overthrown. Then, perhaps even more complicating, is the fact that tons of weapons leaked out of post-Gaddafi Libya into neighboring Mali, which led to a surge in strength of religious zealots who are now putting enormous pressure on the government in Mali, Bamako. The government of Ibrahim Boubacar Keita might not be long for this world. And that could lead to religious zealots, I'm afraid to say, coming into power in Mali. Already you have a French expeditionary force seeking to bolster that regime, but that's only adding gasoline to the flame. And this unrest in Mali is also having knock-on effects negatively with regard to what's going on in the neighborhood, in Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire, in Senegal, Ghana, even northern Nigeria. Now, back to Libya, because there's so much chaos, it's helped to induce the intervention of other powers, Turkey not least. And I don't think many of our friends in the Pan-African world are paying sufficient attention to Turkey's role on the continent of Africa, which is growing at a spectacular pace. And Turkey has intervened on the side of the regime in Libya, whereas neighboring Egypt has been debating whether to send its forces across the border to help those who are trying to overthrow that regime. At the same time, Egypt is in conflict with Ethiopia because Ethiopia has built a dam on the Nile River, which Egypt considers to be its lifeblood, and that's brought these two African giants also to the point of conflict. So this is a very complex scenario. And then, if I may, let me skip southward, because there's some breaking news from Mozambique. You might recall that it was approximately 1975 that FRELIMO, a liberation movement headed by Samora Machel, came to power in Mozambique after a bitter war of liberation. This regime was not accepted supinely by the United States, which tried to overthrow it by any means necessary. And ultimately, the apartheid authorities were involved in the assassination of Samora Machel. Well, Mozambique nonetheless played a historic role in backing liberation movements in Zimbabwe and South Africa, not least. But now it's literally under the gun because some of the friends of Washington's friends, speaking of Saudi Arabia, speaking of religious zealots, have now taken over a major port in Mozambique as we speak. And the danger is that Mozambique's neighbors, Zimbabwe, South Africa, will seek to repay the favor by intervening on the side of the regime in Maputo. But that in turn will cause the religious zealots to start attacking Harare, Zimbabwe, Cape Town, Pretoria, et cetera. And the whole sub-region could go up in flames in the midst of a pandemic. And then there's some startling news coming out of Zimbabwe. You may have heard that a successful reparations claim has been pressed in Zimbabwe.
Yes, yes.
The problem is that the reparations are to the European farmers who had their land expropriated under the previous regime. And the current regime, which is under U.S. sanctions, by the way, continued by the 44th U.S. president and the 45th U.S. president. And if there's a 46th U.S. president, he will probably continue the sanctions too. And so they saw an alternative to try to borrow $3 billion to pay off hundreds of these farmers. And at the same time, where reparations claims, for example, the reparations claim in neighboring Namibia against the German government, which at the turn of the 20th century liquidated a good deal of the Nama and Herero people, is now basically bogged down. Berlin is not budging. At the same time, Zimbabwe has to go to the capital market to borrow $3 billion to pay off folks who made fortunes from exploiting African labor in African land.
Talk about irony of ironies. Now talk about Ethiopia.
Well, it's a very complicated situation for Ethiopia. On the one hand, not least because of close relations with China, they've had an economy that's been growing at double digits for the last few years. But they've been hit hard by the pandemic. I mean, for example, Ethiopian Airways, which, as I pointed out in my book, Storming the Heavens, was basically started by black Americans some decades ago, as early as the late 1930s, and when You had black Americans by way of Mississippi and Chicago who went to Ethiopia to bolster the regime of His Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie, the Lion of Judah, when it was under siege by Italian fascists. Well, the pandemic, as you know, has wounded airlines, Ethiopian Airways not least, which was really the most profitable and well-connected airline on the African continent. It was basically the Pan-African Airways because it flew to more African cities connecting, as a matter of fact, Ethiopian Airways flies out of the United States to the continent as well. So the pandemic has hurt Ethiopian Airways. And then, of course, there are these lingering and persisting national ethnic questions. For example, despite the fact that Abiy Ahmed, the prime minister, won a Nobel Peace Prize for his seeming ability to broker peace with Eritrea, a one-time province of Ethiopia, which fought to secede and succeeded. Conflicts have not disappeared. And then there's the conflict with the Oromo within today's Ethiopia, which you have certain Oromo leaders who complain that Abiy Ahmed's government is not sufficiently forthcoming with regard to their interests and needs. And so this conflict with Egypt could not have come at a more inopportune time.
Let's go south of us to Guyana and Venezuela.
Well, I'm sure you have something to say about this, but as you know, a few months ago, there was a hotly contested election in Guyana, the only English-speaking country on the continent of South Africa that is considered to be part of the Caribbean community, a leading member of CARICOM.
South America.
Oh, what did I say?
South Africa.
Oh, God. Sorry. Excuse me. Sorry. I'm glad you corrected me. In any case, the way the election has been constructed, and I'm choosing my words carefully, is a contest between a party that caters to a substantial population of South Asian descent and a party that caters to a population largely of African descent. Now, that particular real and imagined conflict has roots at least going back to 1953, when the People's Progressive Party, led by the Guyanese patriot of South Asian origin, Chetty Jagan, came to power 6 years before the Cuban Revolution, espousing socialism, which outraged and infuriated U.S. imperialism, which did everything in its power to destabilize the Jagan regime, up to and including seeking to pander to Forbes Burnham, a leader of African descent, who has contestations with Jagan and the PPP, which, by the way, as noted, suggested that it was a socialist-oriented party. And this was the pattern for decades in Guyana. And with regard to this election that just took place, after a lot of wrangling, it appears that the party of Jagan has prevailed, but the lineal descendant of the party of Burnham is not necessarily pleased with that outcome. And I think part of the problem is that a major offshore find of oil has been discovered, quote unquote, by ExxonMobil, and many are eyeing the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow that this oil find will help to deliver, which will line the pockets of many. And that has added fuel to the fire. And then, of course, the Yankees would like to have Guyana in conflict with its neighbor in Venezuela. I don't have to recite, I'm sure, the conflicts between Caracas and Washington. There's a longstanding territorial claim that Venezuela has against Guyanese territory that stretches back decades. So there's a lot of kindling there for a potential raging fire. But I'm hoping that our Cuban friends will be able to mediate any possible conflict that emerges.
Well, neither of them could afford it right now on many levels. You just cannot afford open conflict with each other. It's not going to serve anybody's interests. In Venezuela, what do you see, considering that the United States seems to be pushing aggressively at provoking Venezuela into doing something? What do you make of the latest attempt by the United States to provoke an open conflict with Venezuela?
Well, you may recall the Bay of Pickles in May 2020. You had an invasion team from South Florida that in a symbolic fashion sought to invade Caracas and capture President Maduro and export him, deport him, send him back to the United States to stand trial. Of course, it ended just recently with some of the perpetrators getting prison sentences of double digits in years. And I trust that that will serve as a deterrent for any other would-be mercenaries with fevered dreams about invading Caracas. At the same time, it's apparent, and it's once again citing the memoir by John Bolton, The Room Where It Happened, Mr. Bolton writes that Mr. Trump was even more gung-ho about overthrowing Maduro than he was. I mean, you know, Mr. Bolton has never seen a war he didn't like. So that was a rather chilling assertion. At the same time, part of the good news is that Brian Hook, who was the special U.S. envoy to Iran, has stepped down. And Elliot Abrams, who you may recall was caught up in the Iran-Contra scandal of some decades ago, and only avoided jail time because of a last-minute pardon by the then U.S. president, Elliot Abrams has taken both portfolios, Iran and Venezuela. He's in charge of trying to overthrow those two regimes. And the good news is I think he'll be overburdened. I think that he's proven himself to be incompetent, and taking on another portfolio will only serve to deepen his incompetence. And that is good news. And so if I were a betting man, I would wager that it's going to be exceedingly difficult to topple the Maduro regime. And by the way, we need to put pressure on London as well, because for whatever reason, Venezuela has stored a good deal of its gold in London. Yes. And yet London now won't give it up. They say that the usurper, Juan Guaido, whose main backing seems to be in Washington, actually is the custodian of that gold. And Venezuela uses that gold in terms of its many exchanges with Iran, which has become one of its key partners, along with Russia, China, and once again, Turkey.
We'll take a little break and come back to your questions at 888-874-4888. Our guest is Gerald Horn, the author of the just published book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. We'll be right back. To Lead Stories on PRN.FM. Our guest today, Professor Gerald Horn, and he's been giving us a tour of the hot spots. He's been talking to us about the official announcement yesterday that Kamala Harris has been selected as Joe Biden's running mate as vice president. Your questions at 888-874-4888. Because of time, please keep your questions short. Daryl from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Daryl McPherson, Bronx. How are you, Utrice?
Hello.
And Gerald Horn, my hero. Orange Juice See? Jones, Gerald. What I wanted to know is how do we get this information out into the community in a fashion in which they're willing to listen to it, in the context that there's some confusion in the street and out of the street with regard to the COVID-19 and what have you. And the information that you're imparting is like key and essential to make any kind of sense of this insanity.
Well, I mean, that's the $64 question. Utrice is the communications expert. She's experienced for decades with newspapers.
Bring back the City Sun and come back to New York and help us organize.
Oh, my goodness.
So
both of you have obligations. That's Bronx, New York, Utrice.
Oh, okay. I wrote it down.
That's all right. It matters not in the context that the information that you're – I call everybody I know whenever I hear Gerald going to be on anything, because you know, my reading capability isn't what it needs to be. So the gems that he imparts, it's like, hello, who knew about what's happening in Bamako and Ethiopia? I mean, it's like, I know. I'm just taking up time. I just want to bring.
But this
I just
is
want
a
to
good
thank
thing.
You all for the
this
coverage.
This is a good thing about. I've known Gerald for quite some time, and the one thing I can absolutely say is his consistency. He's one of the hardest working scholars I know, and he's always producing new books. In fact, he has two online right now that he needs to finish, one on jazz and the other on boxing. So you would think that, you know, you'd be talking these academic things, but actually the thing I like about his work is that he sees the full spectrum of our expression. Everything is equally worth studying, and studying at a level that people would be surprised at. You know, a book about boxing, who cares about that? Well, he does. And because he does, he makes us care about it, because so much of what we need to know is missed, is missed and dismissed. Thanks, Daryl, for your call, and thanks for your encouragement. Gwen from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, Utrice. I had a conversation with a friend of mine the other day, and you know, I was telling her about the Middle Passage, as much as I know, and I said, you know, it's just as bad, if not worse, than the Holocaust. And she immediately said, no, it was not. It was never. And I got really upset because I really believed it was. But before I sit down and do my own writing on comparing and contrasting, I wondered if you could recommend something, a book that would that does compare and contrast the two. That's my first question. My second question is, I'm really concerned about when you talked about going to war with China. It's terrifying to me that this country would think about going to war with China. Half the world's population sits there. And I really, really hate Trump, and I don't like Biden either. I would only be voting for Biden in order to not vote for Trump. The only thing I think that Trump did, though, and it was a positive, was I do think he kept us out of war with Russia. So in your opinion, do you think that the Democratic Party is more likely to take us war with China, or do you think that we're in the same position no matter what party we vote for?
Well, first, thank you for that question. First of all, footnote, just for the record, my book on jazz is out, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music, available at better bookstores everywhere. second of all, with regard to the Holocaust versus the African slave trade, I can't think of any books that have compared the two. You could only say that the African slave trade, you could say that it lasted from 1500 to the time that slavery was abolished in Brazil in 1888. And the Holocaust, as tradition can see, lasts from the rise of Hitler in the early 1930s till he's overthrown in 1945. So I'm not sure what the value is of comparing these horrors. As a matter of fact, comparing them, it seems to me, I don't really see that as a useful exercise, with all due respect. But if you have to compare them, look at my book on the 16th century, which has a lot in it about the African Holocaust, and has a lot in it as well about Jewish history and how that intersects with the African Holocaust, because, of course, the Jewish population is expelled from Spain in 1492, and then in their diaspora go on to play a key role in mapping out parts of Africa that then become prey to the African slave trade. So it's a very complicated question, more complicated than people who comment on it tend to realize. Now, with regard to China, well, it's no question that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, your senator from New York, or as hawkish on China, if not more so, than Mr. Trump is. Now, I don't want to enter the realm of speculation and say who will be first to launch a ghastly war against the second largest economy. That's just speculation. And as much as possible, I like to steer clear of speculation.
Thanks, Gwen, for your question.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. All right, so Gerald, what are you looking for as of tomorrow? What are you looking at, I should say?
What do you mean, in terms of the news or in terms of what?
Yeah, in terms of this development that we've been discussing with Biden.
Oh, I see.
And the U.S. elections.
Oh, I see. Well, you know, Biden-Harris is supposed to have their coming out debut this afternoon in Wilmington, Delaware. We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens with regard to the attack line of the Trump team. As I said, I'm sure Willie Brown would be part of the attack. Willie's going to get another day in the sun, I'm afraid to say. Buckle your seatbelts, because you'll have many, I'm afraid to say, looking for an excuse to back Mr. Trump, who has bungled the pandemic. The United States is number one in terms of deaths globally, with no end in sight, and presiding over an economy that's plummeting at record speed. At the same time, there's unrest from New York to Chicago to Portland. But yet, some of his supporters are still willing to cast a ballot for him. I guess they want to go down with the ship and take the rest of us with them.
Well, we have an incoming call that we should take, try to take it. I don't know what it's about, but it's from Leona from Michigan. Hello, Leona. You got to make it quick today. Is she there? Oh, she hung up. But that's okay. She consistently asks great questions. So I thought maybe she gave up, because she thought she was too late in calling in. But so goes the world. Well, I want to thank you, Gerald, for being with us again today. And we have to figure a way to feature you very regularly, because nobody teaches the way you do. And the information, the corners that you go to find these bits of information, nobody seems to go there either. So I want to thank you so much for your work. You're always being productive. You're always searching out new information and writing new books. You're a great servant of the whole community in this regard. So I thank you very much and for being with us today. And I look forward to you coming back real soon. whenever you have an idea that you'd like to talk about, please don't forget to give me a call.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. That brings us to the end of our program today. Thank you all for listening and for calling in with your questions. And we'll talk to each other again tomorrow. Bye-bye.